gleaming, futuristic megacities. China has many of them.
I don't even recognize how impressive or extraordinary they are in the city as opposed to someone who comes here for the first time.
They grew at a mind-boggling pace with help from central planning. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, we're talking about China as a global superpower, from tech innovations to military might. The next 12 months, though, might reveal fragility.
It's going to be very difficult for the world economy to have a good year ahead if China doesn't correct its own growth model.
There's also tension with that island off of China's coast.
China believes that Taiwan is part of China and wants the rest of the world to agree with them.
Taiwan has heavy metal music on its side, though.
We're looking at China today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for being with us today. If I say superpower, I am betting two countries come to mind, the United States and the People's Republic of China.
50 years ago, the idea that China would be a major global rival to the U.S. was tough to imagine. The country was overwhelmingly poor in the 1970s. Most of the population lived in rural areas. Today, China is a high-tech powerhouse.
We start our special one-hour broadcast all about China in the southern megacity of Shenzhen, population 20 million. The World's Jeremy Siegel explains how Shenzhen sidestepped problems typical of cities that undergo rapid growth, like air pollution and overcrowding, to become a global hub of commerce and tech.
It is a hot day in Shenzhen. Nearly 100 degrees, even though it's almost winter. During summers here, the heat can be unbearable. But that's not much of a problem for Wen Xin, a 20-something who was born and raised in Shenzhen. Her parents were migrants who came to the city seeking economic opportunity. I find her sitting behind a computer inside a small milk tea shop. Wen Xin, who tells me I can call her Wendy, isn't tied to an office, so she often comes to places like this to get her work done. It's convenient, cool, and easy. The milk tea shop we're sitting in is located inside a massive mall, one of 800-some malls spread throughout Shenzhen, most of them connected to metro stations by underground tunnel. The metro itself is pristine, easy to navigate, and massive. Train cars are even organized by how cool they are, from moderate temperature to ice-cold AC. It only opened in 2004, but it's already the fifth longest metro system in the world, and getting bigger by the day. Shenzhen is constantly expanding, and its infrastructure along with it. That's part of what drew Daniel Camilu to the city.
Just here where we're sitting, literally almost every building around us didn't exist when I came here first.
Camilu is a Portuguese expat who moved to Shenzhen after the 2008 financial crisis.
So it was really hard to get a job back in Portugal. And I've been here ever since, and I've been working in tech basically the whole time I've been here, in marketing mostly. Started in a software company, then e-commerce, a smartphone, and then in a gaming publisher.
His story is in many ways emblematic of the Shenzhen experience. The city is built on tech, economic opportunity, and manufacturing. Shenzhen was China's first special economic zone and experienced a huge boom in foreign investment in the 80s and 90s before becoming a hub for homegrown tech companies in the 2000s. All of this led to unprecedented population growth, unlike anything in modern times. But the city has somehow managed to keep up, not just with basics like clean air and water, electricity and housing, but with striking, hyper-modern architecture that feels straight out of science fiction.
I think that the city is incredibly young.
That's Ole Scherin, a German-born architect and urbanist who's responsible for many of the buildings that have come to define Shenzhen's futuristic skyline.
It's both young in terms of its own age, merely 3-4 decades, but it's also incredibly young in terms of its population.
That youthfulness that Sharon's describing is hard to miss. In addition to the young workforce that drives the city's economy, there are babies and young children everywhere. a combination of urban convenience and ample green space, more than any other major city in China, makes it an easy place to raise children. Virtually all transportation is electric, drastically reducing the smog that you might find in other parts of the country. Sharon says he and other architects shaping the city have worked hard to achieve a balance between city convenience and natural beauty. Now, while it's tempting to look at Shenzhen's development and say, hey, why can't other growing cities do the same thing? It's important to note that Shenzhen is in a unique situation compared to other major population hubs. First off, most of it didn't exist before 1980. So the city's planning department, the designers of the Shenzhen Metro, and architects like Sharon, they got to start with a blank canvas. On top of that, there's China's authoritarian political and economic system.
I think the key for Shenzhen is that this really benefits from the central government.
That's Jinfen Zhang, a Shenzhen-based finance professor.
The central government, they support, they provide a lot of help. And also, China has this capacity to build up the infrastructure very quickly, very efficiently.
But those benefits come with drawbacks. Surveillance is everywhere. It's hard to go more than just a couple steps on the street before confronting some sort of camera tracking your every move. You have to go through security at every subway entrance. And when you swipe in at the metro gate, a camera equipped with facial recognition technology scans your face. On top of that, Shenzhen is widely panned across the country for just being kind of boring. Wendy from the milk tea shop told me that all she really does for fun is go to the gym. And here's how Daniel, the Portuguese expat, describes his day-to-day.
My lifestyle here is pretty, I don't want to say monotonous, but pretty homey. Like, I stay at home a lot of time.
Shenzhen, by virtue of being one of China's newest big cities, does not have a very extensive culture of the sort that Shanghai or Beijing or Hangzhou or Chengdu residents might feel very proud of.
That's Dan Wong, a technology analyst and author of the book Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future, which explores the positives and negatives of China's immense growth over the past few decades.
But it is a place of fantastic entrepreneurial hustle, where people get together over coffee or dinner, work out a business plan, and start executing the very next day.
That hustle, Wong says, is what's allowed Shenzhen to leave other parts of the world in the dust. For the world, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Shenzhen, China.
We'll hear more of Jeremy's reporting from China throughout the hour.
About 500 miles from Shenzhen is the island of Taiwan. It's a self-governing democracy and home to more than 23 million people. But China insists that Taiwan is a renegade province that will one day be reunited with the motherland. This is why only a tiny number of countries officially recognize Taiwan as an independent state, and it's risky for any government to challenge Beijing's claim over Taiwan. Japan learned about this back in November, as the world's Matthew Bell reports.
Chinese leader Xi Jinping reached out and shook hands with Japan's Prime Minister Sanae Takeuchi. It was all very cordial as they smiled for the cameras. The two leaders talked about a new era of cooperation between China and Japan. But just a few days later, things took a turn. Takeuchi was asked in the Japanese parliament, what would Japan do if China imposed a blockade or attacked the island of Taiwan? The prime minister answered by saying this scenario could lead to a military response by Japan's self-defense forces. The Chinese government took immediate offense.
There is only one China in the world, and Taiwan is part of China.
That's Chinese government spokesperson Chun Bin-hua speaking at a news conference in Beijing through an interpreter. Daisuke Kawai is a lecturer at the University of Tokyo. He explained to me over the phone that Takeuchi said something out loud that previous Japanese prime ministers always left unsaid.
She said that if China used force against Taiwan, she mentioned that the scenario like a blockade that could become a survival-threatening situation for Japan.
The phrase survival-threatening situation is a trigger under Japanese law for using military force. Kawai says opinion polls show that the Japanese public sees China as a threat, and a broad majority views Taiwan as an independent democratic country. But he says people in Japan also realize that recognizing the island formally as being separate from China would create an immediate crisis with their large and powerful neighbor. And no one wants to go to war with China, he says. Beyond the spat with Japan, the government in Beijing also expressed anger toward the European Union. This is after Bi Kim-xiao, the sitting vice president of Taiwan, was invited to speak in the EU Parliament building in Brussels.
Peace in the Taiwan Strait is essential to global stability and economic continuity.
Xiao urged governments in Europe to expand their security and trade ties with Taiwan and to support its democratic freedoms. Evan Medeiros is a professor of Asian studies at Georgetown School of Foreign Service.
The Taiwan issue is the most sensitive issue in China's foreign relations. Taiwan is central to the legitimacy of the Communist Party. China believes that Taiwan is part of China and wants the rest of the world to agree with them so eventually they can achieve unification.
After World War II, the losing army in the Chinese Civil War fled to Taiwan. That's where Chiang Kai-shek set up the Republic of China. When Mao Zedong founded the People's Republic of China on the mainland in October 1949, he made unification a top priority. This was about securing China's borders after 100 years of shame and humiliation imposed by foreign imperialist powers.
The Chinese Communist Party and Mao have always put unification of China, getting back those lost territories, Hong Kong, Tibet, Macau, and now Taiwan, as central to the identity of the People's Republic of China.
So for China, Taiwan represents unfinished national business. For the United States, support for Taiwan's democratic government and its military forces is rooted in the Cold War and an anti-communist worldview. Medeiros says Taiwan does not represent a national security threat to China. It's more serious than that. Taiwan is a threat to the identity of the People's Republic and the Communist Party.
It suggests that you could have this entity that is separate and distinct, is a democracy, by the way, a Chinese democracy. So implicitly saying there is a political alternative. But most importantly, its very existence suggests that the Chinese Communist Party has not completed what Mao promised to do when he formed the PRC in October of 49.
This is what makes the current diplomatic spat between China and Japan more fraught. Evan Medeiros says there's another factor at play here.
The worst-kept secret in Washington is that President Trump has, at best, an ambivalence towards Taiwan.
President Trump is expected to make a state visit to China in April, and it's likely that he will be hearing a lot about Taiwan from the Chinese leadership. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
As Taiwan tries to build international support in the face of threats from China, its top representative in Finland is taking a novel approach to diplomacy. That's Taiwanese envoy and heavy metal vocalist Freddie Lim opening a concert in Helsinki at the end of November.
Formosa Finland Fest had three Taiwanese bands and three Finnish bands, all catering to Finland's love of heavy metal. This Taiwanese broadcaster, Formosa News, offered these details about the diplomat and rocker, Mr. Lim.
Halfway through the concert, he even ripped off his top and showed his chiseled torso with a spectacular eight-pack.
In addition to apparently being in great shape, Lim is an unapologetic critic of the Chinese government. He says heavy metal diplomacy can both unite people and get under China's skin.
Fans came out in droves to Formosa Fest, so evidently Lim can read the room.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. If you're listening to us in the car on American roads, chances are your vehicle is gas-powered. That is not so in China. As we spend this hour focused on the People's Republic, it's impossible to ignore its electric car industry. Nearly three-quarters of the world's EVs are manufactured there.
The World's Jeremy Siegel takes us back to Shenzhen in southern China, the city that's home to the electric car giant BYD.
Standing beside the main road in Shenzhen, you almost forget you're in a city of some 20 million people. On the surface, it looks like what you'd expect in a bustling megacity, a sea of headlights, hubcaps, and hellish traffic. But the roar of engines you'd usually find on a major thoroughfare, virtually non-existent.
I've not been in an internal combustion engine car since living here because every car is electric.
That's Bridget McCarthy, an American who moved to Shenzhen 3 years ago for work. We meet up in the city's Nanshan neighborhood, a business district home to thousands of tech companies. Out on the street, we see a sea of all-electric taxis made by the Shenzhen-based car company BYD, painted in a uniform blue and white. A bus pulls up to the curb, also BYD, also electric, with hordes of passengers hopping out and heading into a mall where Chinese-made electric cars are sold alongside trendy T-shirts, designer handbags, milk tea, and fried chicken. When we get inside the mall, McCarthy tells me this is all normal in Shenzhen. The local government has been at the forefront of requiring vehicles to go electric, and EVs have just become a given in everyday life.
Like, the buses in Shenzhen have been completely electric since 2017. Uh-huh. The taxis have been completely electric since 2018. That was when people weren't even buying passenger vehicles. And now, I think the most recent stat is, as of August, 85% of new vehicles sold here are fully electric.
McCarthy works for a hedge fund called Snowball Capital, which invests in EVs and green energy companies. They used to be based in the U.S., and McCarthy tells me years ago, she would never have imagined ending up here.
Basically, we were never planning on living in Shenzhen or China, but more and more as China kind of climbs the ladder in terms of tech, we started realizing most of our holdings were in China, and a lot of them, they're headquartered in Shenzhen.
Now, McCarthy tells me, it's hard to imagine being anywhere else. Huawei, China's version of Google, Tencent, the Chinese social media giant, DJI, the drone maker, and, of course, BYD, are all based here. The reason Shenzhen has become widely known as the Silicon Valley of China.
So Shenzhen has a lot of its roots as the hardware capital of the world.
That's Dan Wong, a technology analyst and author of the book Breakneck, which details how China is undergoing a technological revolution. Back in the 80s and 90s, he says, Shenzhen, which was the first city in China to open to foreign commerce, was nicknamed the world's factory. It was a place where foreign companies, enticed by government incentives, could go to have their products built with cheap labor. But then everything changed in the early 2000s.
When a very important company, Apple, decided to make the iPhone in Shenzhen.
At the time, Wong tells me, the decision didn't seem that consequential. Just another thing that'd be built in China. What Apple didn't realize was that outsourcing its production to Shenzhen would spark a new era of innovation.
What Apple was doing was training hundreds of thousands of Chinese workers every single year to make the most sophisticated electronic product in the world.
According to Wong, teaching Chinese workers to make iPhones was kind of like the old teach a man to fish proverb. Apple gave them a new skill and inspired a new generation of entrepreneurs with technical know-how.
A lot of these workers would move from making an Apple iPhone in their first year, maybe to making a Huawei phone the next year. And then they may be putting together a DJI drone, and then maybe an even more complex product, the electric vehicle batteries.
BYD, now synonymous with electric vehicles, wasn't even a car company to begin with. In the 90s and early 2000s, it built batteries for cell phones. But Wang says workers who learned from Apple and other American companies that move production to Shenzhen helped the company transform from battery maker to unknown car company, now to the world's top EV maker. In less than 20 years, Shenzhen, with BYD at its center, went from the world's factory to the world's premier innovation hub.
I think this is a city full of hope, full of stories, full of legendary stories, full of successful stories.
Finance professor Jinfen Zhang is an expert on the development of Shenzhen's economy. He says beyond the tech know-how acquired in manufacturing foreign products, the local economy has benefited heavily from the Chinese government.
The dynamics here comes from the private sector, but the government provides some support behind it. I think all this merged together to achieve this really extremely fast development.
The central government has pumped billions of dollars into BYD, helping it to refine their technology and flood the international market with cheap, efficient cars. Their fast charger only takes 5 minutes, and the company's lowest-end EV, the Seagull, goes for roughly $8,000, a seventh the price of the average EV in the U.S. Critics, including the United States, call these practices unfair. Here's how former President Joe Biden described the practice in a speech last year.
China heavily subsidized all these products, pushing Chinese companies to produce far more than the rest of the world can absorb, and then dumping the excess products onto the market at unfairly low prices, driving other manufacturers around the world out of business. It's not competition, it's cheating.
But supporters like Bridget McCarthy, whose firm is invested in BYD, say government support has allowed BYD to not only build cars, but to export a clean energy revolution.
I'm a huge believer in BYD's dream of actually becoming an energy company, not just a car company. And I think if we look at countries like Brazil, where they already have a huge market share, or Mexico, like, these are countries that without a company like BYD, they wouldn't really be able to progress into the future in terms of green energy.
For now, there are still parts of the world, like the U.S. and Canada, where you can't buy a BYD because of protectionist tariffs. But McCarthy says it's not a matter of if, but when that changes, because Chinese EV technology is simply too far ahead and too cheap for America to go it alone. For the World, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Shenzhen, China.
Electric cars are only part of the story. Ahead this hour, we'll hear more of Jeremy's reporting on how China's car industry is bringing new technology to other parts of daily life.
All this hour, we're examining the political and economic forces that have made China a global superpower and how the rest of the world is changing as a result. Stay with us. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Factories in China are in overdrive, and the numbers show it. For the first time ever this fall, China's trade surplus surged past $1 trillion. We recently asked economist Ishwar Prasad to help us understand what this means for the global economy. He specializes in trade policy at Cornell University.
The way China has managed to sustain its growth is essentially by providing a lot of credit to its companies, which are now pumping out a huge amount of goods. And those goods are just not being purchased by Chinese households because demand there is quite weak. So China has little option but to export all of the goods that its factories are producing, which cannot be consumed fully domestically, to markets around the world. And that's why we're seeing such a large trade surplus, simply because China has to sell its goods somewhere.
So those big container ships are still leaving China, just not coming as much as they used to the United States.
That's right. Although there are two phenomena that are going on here. First of all, China is exporting a lot to other countries, and consumers in those countries are getting the benefit of cheap Chinese goods. But also some Chinese exports are being diverted through other countries, such as Vietnam and Mexico, where there are lower tariffs on imports into the U.S. So essentially, this trade diversion is part of the story as well. So the U.S. is not importing as much directly from China, But its overall imports from China through direct and indirect channels, which means other countries, is not as low as the overall figures might suggest.
So some of that product, you're saying, is going to Vietnam and Mexico and then being pressed on to the United States.
That's right. And in addition, China is also setting up factories in places like Vietnam and Mexico to get around U.S. tariffs. But it is also transshipping goods through those countries.
What other countries are the goods going to directly from China if they're not headed to the U.S.?
Practically every other country. There are countries in Southeast Asia, Japan, Europe, Africa, and Latin America. So basically, Chinese exports are flooding the world markets. And this is making it very difficult for manufacturers in other countries to compete with China.
So what kind of goods are Chinese factories churning out? Are we talking high-tech kind of gadgets or lower value goods like toys and clothes?
It's the whole gamut. It goes from very low value added, low cost and low price manufacturing goods such as toys, textiles, footwear and so on, to high-end electronics, televisions, computers and so on. And of course, there are high technology industries like electric vehicles and solar panels where China is coming to dominate the world market. And those account for a significant chunk of its exports as well.
Ishwar, does all this tell us that China is really just less reliant on U.S. consumers than had been touted?
It is a lot less reliant on U.S. consumers, and this is certainly creating a problem for the world economy because China is the second largest economy in the world. And if the U.S. is shutting off its consumers away from world exports and China is now flooding the world with exports, it certainly puts other countries in a very difficult position.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. But first, what does this export-heavy economy mean for the average Chinese worker? Are wages rising, stagnating, or shrinking right now?
Chinese industrial profits have been very weak, and there is cutthroat competition among Chinese manufacturers. So they have been dropping prices. And in fact, China has had very little inflation. And in fact, by some measures, has been stuck in deflation, which means prices have been falling simply because producers have to keep producing, and this is causing some firms to go under. It's forcing them to cut their profits, and it's forcing them to cut their prices. And the net result is that workers are not doing terribly well either. There have been significant problems with unemployment rising, and in addition, Chinese workers' wages are not doing terribly well either.
So if we step back a bit, put China's export boom against a backdrop of the global economy, what does all this mean for countries in Europe that, for example, are gobbling up things like Chinese EVs or countries in Latin America that are making deals with China around products like soybeans, creating new relationships and new dependencies?
This is an existential concern for certain countries, especially those like Germany, Japan, and many others in Asia that rely on exports for their own growth. Now, many of these economies have not been doing terribly well in the post-COVID period. Now they find they cannot easily export to the U.S. because of the tariffs on their exports to the U.S. And now they're being flooded with exports from China. So it really affects their own industries. And it has caused significant concerns, say, in countries like Germany, that their manufacturers in industries that they have traditionally been very strong at, such as automobiles, high-end electronics, industrial equipment, and so on, that they could be swamped by more competitive Chinese manufacturers. So there is a great deal of concern around the world.
So if you look at the China factor right now, what kind of health grade do you give the global economy? And are the trends being kind of forced by China, are they sustainable?
It's going to be very difficult for the world economy to have a good year ahead if China doesn't correct its own growth model. If China cannot boost its domestic consumption, it's certainly going to drag down growth in the rest of the world. If the second largest economy in the world is going to rely on the rest of the world to consume its products rather than creating more final demand itself, it's going to be a problem for the world economy. Ultimately, the solution has to come from China itself. Its government needs to undertake policies that rebalance economic growth so that it's driven more by household consumption rather than by investment. Until that happens, it's going to be tough sledding for China as well as the world.
Ishwar Prasad is an economist who studies global trade policy at Cornell University. We spoke last month. Thank you.
Earlier this hour, we heard about China's global dominance in electric vehicles. Chinese automakers are also at the cutting edge of self-driving cars, and they're using that technology to revolutionize many different aspects of daily life, like street-sweeping robots and delivery drones. Also think surveillance drones, with the race to develop those innovations going full steam ahead. Here again is The World's Jeremy Siegel reporting from a car show in the southern Chinese city of Shenzhen.
As I walk into the Automotive World China exhibition, I am immediately drawn to a car. It's a Chinese-made electric SUV called the iCar. I hop in and ask through my interpreter how much it costs. 19,000. That's not bad.
Yeah.
It's billed as an affordable, rugged, retro-style car. On the outside, it looks kind of like a Land Rover from the 1960s, with big circular headlights and glitzy chrome detailing. On the inside, it feels like a futuristic spaceship equipped with buttery, highly cushioned, heated seats that feel like a warm glove.
It feels pretty good. It's comfortable. I want to test out the horn, but I'm not going to.
I think people from the U.S. would love it, she tells me. The iCar is impressive, as are the other EVs on display here. But as I move through the convention center, I start to realize that the real cutting-edge technology being developed in China is found in smaller, more unassuming vehicles. This is the voice of Yan Ming with the self-driving tech company Rhino AI. He's telling me about their R5 autonomous vehicle, a driverless cargo van that's just received one of the exhibition's top awards. It's basically a simple white square with four wheels. The inside is like one big trunk, notably absent a steering wheel and driver's seat. Instead, on top, there's a series of little cameras, radars, and a 3D light sensor that helps the van sense cars and pedestrians that might be nearby. I'm curious how close the technology is to being ready for the real world.
Can these drive on regular streets where cars are driving?
Yes, right here.
Ming sounds surprised when I ask this question and begins to tell me that they're not only capable of driving on city streets, they already are, including here in Shenzhen. The company has partnered with supermarkets, factories, and delivery companies in more than 150 Chinese cities, shipping food and parcels all around, no driver needed. I ask him what products like this could mean for the tens of thousands of delivery workers driving around cities like Shenzhen every day. Ming says these autonomous vans won't replace delivery drivers, but will make their jobs easier, handling longer routes from supermarkets and shipping centers, while drivers themselves will still do the shorter deliveries. Labor advocates, however, warn that self-driving technology has the capacity to destroy whole sectors of jobs. Nearby, I spot another little vehicle that looks nothing like a traditional car or truck. Just like the Rhino cargo van, it's basically a box on wheels. But this one is flashier, with more colors and doodads. Peng Wenming with the company Auto City tells me this is a fully autonomous sanitation device, a fancy way of describing a street cleaning robot. Painted with bright stripes of blue, green, and yellow with fuzzy little orange brushes on the bottom, it scoots along roads and sidewalks to clean the ground below. These sanitation robots, just like the self-driving delivery vans, Wenming says, are already on the ground in Shenzhen and dozens of other Chinese cities. Local officials are welcoming to these experimental technologies. And according to Stanley Ng, that's why in China, innovation is part of everyday life.
Local governments are very aggressive to promote new technology to serve the public here.
Ng is president of the Asia-Pacific Connected Vehicles Association, a government-supported group that works to promote self-driving technology in cities across Asia. He says the quieter, behind-the-scenes industries are where self-driving technology will make the biggest inroads in the coming years, because that's where municipalities and businesses can see huge savings. And even though robo-taxi pilot programs have launched in cities across China, the U.S., and the Middle East, he doesn't think that technology will be widely adopted on a personal level anytime soon, that he and I will keep driving our own cars.
Believe me, you and me will keep our car for coming 20 years.
Interesting.
The reason is we want to drive a car by ourselves, enjoy the driving.
We enjoy driving ourselves, Ng argues, but don't mind letting robots do the heavy lifting when it comes to deliveries, logistics, sanitation. And in those fields, China, with companies like Rhino and Auto City at the forefront, is paving a new, more efficient path. In the evening, after I head out from the auto show, I pause for some fresh air in a city park. A young girl is with her mom, learning to ride a bike with no training wheels. Out of the corner of my eye, I spot one of those brightly colored, self-driving sanitation robots I'd seen earlier at the convention. It's cleaning the park pavement and headed right toward the little girl and her bike. I almost shout something out, but before I do, the robot stops, turns, and starts cleaning in the other direction. The little girl is unfazed, probably used to seeing these things everywhere, and starts pedaling for the first time. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Shenzhen, China.
For years, the U.S. has been pressuring China and Mexico to get control of the illegal supply chain for fentanyl production. The drug is linked to most overdose deaths in the U.S., and most of the fentanyl that ends up in the U.S. is made in Mexico, with ingredients that come from China. This fall, there was some progress on this. An agreement between the U.S. and China says that Chinese companies will need special licenses to ship certain key chemicals to the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The World's Tobias Isaiah reported on this from Mexico City last month.
The basic fentanyl supply chain looks like this.
We have chemicals coming out of China, going to Mexico, used to manufacture synthetic drugs, being shipped into the United States.
Daniel Baldwin works on U.S.-China cooperation against illicit drugs. He says this supply chain has proven hard to disrupt. Now, China says it's regulating 13 chemical precursors used to make fentanyl. The rule basically adds a checkpoint. If a Chinese company wants to ship one of these chemicals, the government now reviews who the buyer is and why.
So this process, right, because it creates a paper trail within the system, potentially could allow law enforcement, say in Mexico, Canada, or the United States, to be able to track that record back to the original shipper.
But Baldwin says enforcing the rules is still a challenge. China's chemical sector is huge, and shipments often pass through several middlemen, making tracing more difficult. Also, traffickers in Mexico often create fake companies to make themselves look like legitimate buyers. And there is another problem. China is only restricting a small fraction of the chemicals used to make fentanyl. Many other ingredients are still completely legal.
Many precursors of fentanyl are used in legal pharmacology, legal pharmaceutical industry, agriculture, legal chemistry. They're just very basic chemicals.
Vanda Felba-Brown is with the Brookings Institution. She says even if China stopped being a source of fentanyl ingredients, traffickers could look for other countries like India, where the pharmaceutical sector is loosely regulated. But there is some hope. This is not the first time China has tightened controls. In 2023, the government started restricting some chemical precursors and the impact showed up quickly in the U.S.
The number of fatal overdoses from fentanyl has declined very substantially over an 18-month period.
That's Peter Reuter, a professor of drug policy and criminology at the University of Maryland. He says 18 months is actually much longer than expected. Drug traffickers usually adapt within a few months to government crackdowns.
What that suggests is that it is not so easy to adapt to this.
Also, during that time, fentanyl on U.S. streets became less potent. Jonathan Calkins, a drug policy researcher at Carnegie Mellon University, says these supply-side shocks won't end the fentanyl trade, but they can still save lives.
So if your standard is we're only interested in something that completely makes the drug supply go away forever, it's not going to do that. But if your standard is, will it save people's lives, maybe even hundreds or thousands of lives, there is hope for that.
He says even modest actions can matter. But in the long run, Calkins says supply controls alone won't solve the crisis.
We will always want law enforcement to prevent the criminal organizations from becoming too powerful, too violent, too damaging to democratic institutions. That's an ongoing, crucial mission.
The bigger challenge, he says, is stopping people from becoming addicted. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
People who were adopted as kids often decide later in life to learn more about where they came from. Robin Reef adopted her daughter, Rosie, from China. The family was only given a little information about Rosie's background. So when she started asking questions, it prompted mother and daughter to travel to China in search of a document that might tell them more. Robin Reef shared what they discovered with GBH's storytelling program, Stories from the Stage.
I think we can all agree that 7,000 miles is a long way to go for a little piece of paper. But that paper was a note that I was told was pinned to my daughter's sweater when she was found on a bridge as an infant in China. And I had been looking for that note ever since Rosie was placed in my arms. But the search got very real one day when she was around 3, and she explained to me, "Mom, you know, babies don't come from moms, they come from China." "Oh, misunderstanding, sweetie. Yes, you come from China, we've always talked about that, but before that, you came from a mom. We have always said you were adopted." "Oh, I thought you said I was a doctor." Well, we had the conversation. Yet again, it's not that we hadn't had it before, but this time she understood. And it was awful. "Mom, Mommy, why did she throw me away? Did she not like me? Mom, do you know her? Can we call her?" I mean, it made my heart hurt, and I was more determined than ever to find that note, if only to prove to Rosie that her worst fears were not true. So I wrote to her orphanage. I had done this before, but I did it again. Wrote to her orphanage, nothing. I wrote to the Central China Adoption Authority, the bureaucrats in Beijing who match you. Silence. I spoke to adoption officials here, who spoke to adoption officials there, got nothing. So by the time we were able to get back to China to look ourselves, Rosie was 11. And she wasn't really talking a lot about her birth mother. She was obsessed with the Hunger Games and begging me to get a dog. I said, "We're going, no matter what." And after a long ride, and I mean 3 beers, pass out, panic attack, finish War and Peace long, we get to Nanjing. Next day, freezing January day, we take off for Yixing, the city where she was found. Our first stop is Huaidi Bridge, the exact spot where she was found. Now, I had always pictured a beautiful crescent bridge, like in the ancient Chinese paintings. Yeah, well, Huaidi is a concrete slab over a polluted canal, but it was our sacred spot. So we stood there. Again, it's a freezing day. We're on the bridge. It's very gray. I look at Rosie. She looks kind of teary. Oh, honey, I know. This is hard. Mommy, Mom, this is so boring. Well, our next stop, I was so excited, was the police station. It was where she was taken after she was found, and we had never been able to identify it, but our translator found the precinct. And it had to be there. It was the only place it could be. So we get there, we are sent up and down and back and forth, and I'm getting anxious, I'm getting hot. Finally, we are sent to the office of the one person we're told can help. And I pour out my tearful request. And she smiles, my heart lifts. And she says, oh, all records before 2005 were lost in a fire. Oh, you heartless witch, you witch. How can you smile? Life was lost in that fire. A part of my daughter was lost in that fire. And I'm thinking, I have no tools here. I can't ask for the manager. I don't speak Mandarin. I can't cry because, yeah, who's going to be sorry for a white lady from New York? I have nothing. And Rosie is saying, Mom, stop it. We're going to get arrested. It's the police. They're going to put us in jail. And our translator is saying, okay, we're going now. And she has her foot in my back, and we are out the door. And we have to show up at the orphanage where the note is not, as I know. We have lunch with the new director. And as we're leaving, she hands me this file. I'm telling you, it's the size of a suitcase. It's enormous. And I had to put it on the table in order to leaf through it. And what I see were adoption papers that I had signed 10 years ago. So I'm thinking, this is weird. So I'm paging through, and I see, stuck between two pages, is this ripped out, crumpled piece of paper with these sort of ballpoint marks. And I take it out gingerly because I don't want to rip it anymore. And I see Mandarin characters and numbers, and I see, well, I'm able to make out Rosie's date of birth, which of course I knew. And then the exact time of her birth, which only her birth parents could possibly know. It was the note. I hand it to Rosie. She looks at it, hands it back with this look like, yeah, Mom, but what I really, really want is a dog. So we're in the car. She's giving me grief. Mom, the note said nothing. So why did we even come? It's like, oh, honey, I know. It's disappointing. But the truth is, I was not disappointed. I got what I came for, because that note answered a question I never would have dared ask out loud. That note was proof that Rosie was not trafficked, and so was not someone's stolen daughter. Rosie was not left to die, as had been so many girls during the one-child policy years. Rosie was left to be found. Thank you.
Robin Reef is a writer from New York City. Her story was produced by our partners at GBH's Stories from the Stage.
Thanks for being with us this hour. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks, as always, for listening. And join us again Monday for the latest news from around the world.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
PRX. From PRX.